This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Matt Fidler. In today's episode, we hear from a couple who lost everything in the Bear Fire. Plus, the head of the North Valley Community Foundation talks about how the campfire prepared it to quickly help survivors of this latest tragedy. And for all of us who are feeling like these crises are never ending, some advice from the Butte County Health Department on how to cope. That's all ahead. If you have questions or comments, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or head over to mynspr.org. For Thursday, September 17th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. Firefighters continue to battle the stubborn North Complex West Fire, also known as the Bear Fire, which blew up in a wind event more than a week ago. 15 people died in the blaze, which destroyed more than 1,000 structures. One of these structures belonged to Scott and Lisa Meyer. The married couple lived in Feather Falls. Lisa is a member of Butte County's Estimwaki Maidu tribe. They spoke this week with NSPR's Andre Bayek at the River Bend Park in Oroville about what their life is like right now as survivors and evacuees.
She had gone to work. I was at home taking care of our property. Went and checked the mail around 9:30, and you could see the smoke clouds starting. At that point, we had been communicating back and forth through morning. At a certain point, we realized the fire was getting too big. We started looking through the house, packing up photo albums, personal things, and whatever little things we could cram into the car. I think around 2, she ended up coming home to help pack more things because I could only fit so much in the car. We had 3 dogs and 3 cats too, so she ended up coming home when ashes were falling. There was large debris, needles, leaves, bark was starting to fall. They'd gave the immediate warning to leave. And we left. That could be it. That's your last moment to see what you had, what you worked for, your history, your heritage, all of it.
Yeah, I actually inherited the property through my father, which the property itself has been in the family for over 80 years. My grandfather and my dad both put a lot of time and money into the property. And then when we moved to it, we did the same. Not only that, just above our property was a traditional Maidu roundhouse, which we twice a year would get together and have gatherings, which we also lost. I think the worst part of it is when you're scared and you're frightened, you know, you're going through all your through your head and you're trying to figure out, you know, what do I need to take? What's more important? Like I told him when we left, I didn't even take a picture of the place when I left because I was so scared. But I should have, because now, I mean, I have memories and I do have pictures, but I think I just wanted to just take one last look, and I didn't even do that. We just left in a hurry as fast as we could. The sky was a dark red behind my house because my house was right next to the canyon where it was coming up. I felt at that moment like when I found out my house was gone, I didn't just lose my house, my property, I lost my history. 2 days ago, we got confirmation by pictures from a family friend who actually was able to go up and walk about the property and take pictures. There was basically nothing left. We left behind equipment, big equipment. We left behind a vehicle, stuff, you know, big stuff that's going to take a lot of money to replace. And unfortunately, because of a fire that happened 3 years ago, it was really hard for us to get our house insured because they would not insure it. It was very expensive and they didn't want to do it because it was in a high fire zone.
You're now going to have to bank on the government, which may or may not come for you, or the hopes that the community may come for you, but there's so many people that's gonna be tough too.
Every day we're on the move. Every day we're going on the internet, scoping out places that are helping evacuees with food and with clothing. Even though we did have a little bit of time to get some clothing and stuff like that, we still left behind a lot of it. We only got whatever we could fit, which was in two little small bags. So we constantly are looking for places that are helping with gas cards, programs that we can apply to, and it's an all-day thing. Sometimes you, like yesterday, we went out and we were getting birth certificates and property deeds and stuff like that. And so, and there's times when you come up against something. I went to go get a property deed, and it was the wrong one. It was not what I needed. I needed a different one, different information. So we went out and we're out all day and came home and kind of felt like that was a complete waste of a day, trying to run around and get all those documents, and then maybe you just hit a wall. It's been like that ever since. We've moved from house to house, friend to friend. Luckily, we have some really good friends and friends that we've met along the way that didn't really even know us, but took us in their home. And so that was really nice.
Friends and what we've been able to gather and what the community has offered so far has been really well to us. Her tribe, Enterprise Rancheria, has helped us with a temporary permanent place to be. I know there's a lot of people who are just sleeping in cars. They have nothing. We've been lucky enough to have quite a few resources through friends and through the Enterprise Rancheria. So we're kind of on the luckier side of this event.
That was Lisa and Scott Meyer speaking with NSBR's Andre Bayek. You heard Lisa talking about all the ways they've been seeking financial help, including gas cards. That was one lesson learned by the North Valley Community Foundation in the aftermath of the campfire. Cash is king, but gift cards are often just as good. The foundation has been putting that knowledge to work on the heels of the Bear Fire. The foundation's president and CEO, Alexa Benson Valenvanis, spoke earlier this week with NSPR's Tess Vigland.
Alexa, you've had the Wildfire Relief and Recovery Fund in place since the early days of the campfire. How did that affect your ability to help this time around, nearly 2 years later?
You know, as an organization, we talk about it quite a bit. It's been such a difficult challenge to deal with the relief and recovery efforts of the campfire, and yet it has positioned us. On day one of the Bear Fire breaking out, we were able to assess what the needs were on the ground because of our partnerships and quickly start deploying resources because of the infrastructure we had in place due to the campfire. So I think it's aided in both speed as well as just efficiency with those relationships already in place.
Can you give us a sense of what you did?
So we immediately opened activated our wildlife fund. And started to see modest contributions coming in. Unlike with the campfire, right now in 2020, we are seeing fires across the entire West Coast, and many, many communities are impacted, and rightfully so. Donors and community members and foundations are directing their resources to their local communities. So we knew we had to go into some of our other coffers and make sure we had resources available for these specific fires. One thing people might not know is the way we raise money with the campfire, we really are still deploying those monies to campfire recovery efforts, and we needed to raise new resources for these new fires. So that was the first step. And fortunately, the open-hearted, loving, generous people of the North State started to contribute. And what we did was we immediately sent out a round of grants to the organizations that were providing help to evacuees. So we had hundreds of families evacuated within the first couple of days after the wind event. So we're talking now about a week and a half ago, I believe. What we did was we made contributions to those partners on the ground that were helping get families into hotels. Unlike with the campfire and even with our COVID-19 work, we can't have large shelters. And so when you have 20,000 people evacuating, what we had to do quickly was partner with organizations that could get them into hotels. So we did that through our partnerships with Red Cross, and many other organizations on the ground that were helping place families in hotels. But similar to the campfire, our small communities were overrun very quickly and reached capacity very quickly. So then we started to work with organizations to figure out what the next steps were and moving folks out of the community that were able to do that, making sure people had gas money, making sure people had food, water, and due to COVID-19, making sure everybody had masks and the necessary supplies to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic as well. So that's what we did, and we've been funding ever since. We've already deployed nearly $100,000 to our partners on the ground to make sure that they have all the supplies that evacuees need. Early on, we made, I believe our first grant was to the North Valley Animal Disaster Group, because they have been evacuating, rescuing animals since day one.
Can you talk about some of the lessons that you did learn from last time that enabled you to perhaps move quickly, even more quickly than last time, for the Bear Fire survivors and evacuees? Like, you know, what are some of the things that you have been using merely because that you are so experienced at this already?
Well, I think, again, the most important lesson was just actually the work of building all the partnerships and relationships. So we didn't have to do that. We are working very closely with all sorts of organizations in Oroville, in surrounding counties and communities. And so the most critical takeaway from the campfire was actually putting in place all the relationships that we would need and making sure something as tactical as having ACH transfer, automated transfer, so that our grants could literally just be over in a matter of minutes be placed into our nonprofit organization's bank accounts. All those things happened due to the campfire. But there were certainly lessons learned. We know how critical gift cards are. We know that evacuees, their realities change by the minute, and setting them up and predicting what those are very challenging. So getting them cash and getting them resources that are flexible, because their lives are very fluid and moving, was a lesson. And we've not only made sure that our partners on the ground are getting them those types of cards, you know, things for gas, food, et cetera, but we're also fully in a campaign to just let other communities and community members send us those types of cards so that we can get it to our partners on the ground.
As someone who lives in the community, a leader in the community, any thoughts you want to share about what has essentially been a re-traumatizing of an entire community? Is it possible yet to have perspective on what this fire means coming so close on the heels of the campfire?
You know, it's hard to say, and it's, of course, everyone's experience is so unique given their life and given what they went through with the campfire in particular. But what I can say is every single community member in Butte County in particular has had and experienced some trauma from the campfire, and it's impossible to not have a reaction when the skies are filled with the type of smoke that they're filled with today. What we've been focused on is a very comprehensive health and wellness initiative. And as fate would have it, we were just days away from rolling that out into the community to address not only the trauma of the campfire, but how that trauma really exacerbated the existing challenges of our rural community. We already had the highest, if not the top three, in terms of adverse childhood experiences for our community members. We already were so challenged by other rural challenges related to resources being available for families. And, you know, the list was very long prior to the campfire. And so what I can say is, I don't know what everyone's individual experience is, but we were just days away from rolling out that program, and we've had to hold on to it, understanding that what we're going to be facing after the North Complex fires is going to be even that much worse for community members. We've, of course, heard the horror stories of somebody that lost their home in the campfire, a whole family, and then moved to Berry Creek. And, of course, we now know Berry Creek was completely destroyed, and they lost their home again. So we have trauma upon trauma. As I've learned from many experts, that just oftentimes triggers other traumas in our life experience. So it's really rough. You know, we are hopeful and optimistic that we will learn from these experiences and move forward and heal as a community. But I don't want to underestimate how challenging it is for Butte County and for these communities to move forward, because it's going to be quite a challenge, both physically in the recovery work, but also in the emotional, spiritual, psychological elements of this as well. Not just for the victims of the flames, but for all the survivors of these fires.
Alexa Benson Valenvanis of the North Valley Community Foundation speaking with NSBR's Tess Vigland. If you would like to contribute to the foundation's Wildfire Relief and Recovery Fund, you can do so at nvcf.org. That's nvcf.org. As she noted, they are also taking contributions of your extra gift cards to be given to fire victims. Coming up, advice for coping with the multitudes of trauma facing all of us at this moment, especially those who've lost everything.
As the traumas continue one after the other, that they can tend to be compounding and having more longer term impacts on people, that is making it difficult for people to function.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features and MSNBC Films presenting The Way I See It. Barack Obama's White House photographer, Pete Souza, takes viewers inside the Oval Office. Rated PG-13. In theaters September 18th. And from WebRoot, offering home antivirus solutions for protecting personal devices against phishing and other cyber attacks while working remotely. Learn more about WebRoot, an open text company, at webroot.com. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, comparing car insurance rates from multiple insurers so shoppers can evaluate options in one place. Now that's Progressive. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From X-Chair, maker of the X2 home office chair, with dynamic variable lumbar support and 10 ergonomic adjustments, donating to Gladstone Research Institute to fight COVID-19 at xchair.com. And from HubSpot, whose enterprise CRM platform is designed to help marketing, sales, and customer service teams generate leads, grow sales, and innovate the customer experience. More at HubSpot.com. Grow better.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Matt Fidler. Finally today, if you're feeling like everything is just crisis after crisis these days, you're not alone. It hasn't even been 2 years since the campfire, and there's the car fire and the wall fire, and of course, the global pandemic and economic turndown. NSBR's Mark Albert talked with Scott Kennelly, director of Butte County Behavioral Health, about how to best cope when your world can't catch a break.
Generally, what happens to people when our lives are so disrupted like this?
I don't think we've seen this kind of level of trauma in many, many years. Typically, traumas come and go, and people can adapt to them and move on. But this level of multi-layer trauma is having quite of an impact on our society. Common reactions to trauma tend to be people have disbelief and they have shock and they tend to have fear and anxiety about the future during the traumatic event. Some people are disoriented, have trouble making decisions. Some people have emotional numbing where they don't really feel anything. But other people have nightmares and irritability and anger, get sad and depressed or feel powerless. And people change their patterns of behaviors. They can change their pattern of sleeping, eating, how they respond to things. And those are some normal short-term reactions to trauma that people experience. But what we're seeing now is as the traumas continue one after the other, that they can tend to be compounding and having more longer-term impacts on people that is making it difficult for people to function day-to-day and to work with each other and family members. And so you're seeing more people having trouble coping and normal coping skills that people would use to get through a single traumatic event aren't necessarily as effective for these multi-layer events that seem to be ongoing.
People know about fight or flight in an instance of danger. Is there something comparable for the kind of short to medium term?
Response to trauma can be like a flight or fight response. Your body activates. A lot of adrenaline starts pumping through you. You prepare for that flight or fight response. But these kind of incidents are not ones that you can run from and be safe immediately. So people are going through stressful responses. Their body is responding, but there doesn't seem to be an end in sight for some people. So their bodies are flooded with cortisol and some of the hormones that produce responses for trauma. And sometimes when you marinate in that, or those chemicals continue to be with you day in, day out, they can have significant negative impacts on you physically and psychologically. The body's response to long-term stress can be things such as anxiety or depression, a lot of digestive issues. You can feel upset stomach, headaches. Some people develop heart disease, sleep problems, weight gain, memory and concentration problems. And overall, that long-term stress response can have more permanent health issues like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, even heart attacks. So it's important for people to maintain their stress levels and try and bring those down as effectively as they can so that they're not marinating in that traumatic response, whether it's a flight or fight response or just the fact that they feel stressed and they don't feel like there's a way out.
Are there typical ways in which the mind recovers or processes surviving potentially deadly situations? Are there places where this can get short-circuited?
So normally, under a normal circumstance, the human mind would see that as a unfortunate event or a challenging, stressful event, unforeseen event, but that the person is a survivor and they got through it and they came out stronger, or they came out a different person, or the family became changed in a positive way. But what we're seeing is that mastery, or that belief that sense of overcoming the situation, a lot of people are instead seeing themselves as victims. Like, when is this going to end? Or I don't think this is going to end. There seems to just be a nonstop flow of negative information coming to people. And so we're really encouraging people not to spend a lot of time on social media, watching the news, or focusing on the trauma or the bad news out there, because too much of that exposure can really impact one's mental health and impact how one views the response to the trauma.
How does this kind of trauma impact children, and how can parents notice that their children need help, and how does this impact the parents' relationship with children? They need to provide security and safety, and obviously in this kind of disaster, that's not possible.
Yeah, it's a tightrope that parents or caregivers have to walk sometimes, because they're having to manage both their own response to the trauma and make sure that their children are coping appropriately. So first things first is, if the parents aren't taking care of themselves or the caretakers aren't taking care of themselves and the youth see it, that's not good for them. It's okay to cry or feel sad around your kids, but it's not okay to be kicking things and screaming and yelling at the TV, or talking in great detail about the trauma or the events that are of concern in front of your kids, particularly the younger they are. Abusing drugs and alcohol in front of your kids is also not necessarily a good thing, because they're watching you, and they're watching you as a role model. So how you take care of yourself, kids tend to watch that and learn and or sometimes adapt or cope with those behaviors in a bad way. So we encourage parents and caregivers to make sure that they're taking care of themselves, they're getting help. But youth respond differently to trauma at different age levels. A child from 0 to 5 years old is very different in their response to a child who's 6 to 19 years old, or a young adult from 18 to 25. And it's important to primarily let the kids know that you care about them and you're interested in their well-being and how they're feeling. And, you know, with little kids, it's very important to get down to their level and hug them, make sure you spend time with them and check in with them and see how they're doing. Those kids, after traumas, tend to regress. They might go back to thumb-sucking, wetting their beds. They may fear strangers, monsters, dark. Their sleeping patterns and things might change. And behaviors immediately after a trauma can be normal. And most kids are very resilient and can get through traumatic events. But sometimes if you don't see behaviors for 2 to 4 weeks following a traumatic event and then a sudden onset of that behavior, that's an indication of concern. With COVID and the fires, an added challenge for the adolescents and the middle children are their primary coping mechanism, which is school, has been taken away from them. They can't go see their friends. They're stuck at home. Their social support network's not there. And so a lot of those kids are isolating more. We sometimes see more aggression in those kids. Some of the things parents can do is encouraging the expression of emotions by their children, either through writing, talking, drawing, or even singing, paying attention to their kids, being a good listener, limiting the internet, for one thing. That seems to be critical. A lot of kids are spending 8, 10, 12 hours online, and that's not good if it's all about trauma. And then, most importantly, modeling self-care and routines.
I imagine this is reawakening the post-traumatic stress for those who endured the campfire. How would someone know if they're going through normal feelings of depression, stress, fear, versus something much more serious that they might need some outside help with?
I think for many people, this is very traumatic, like a re-experiencing of the campfire or the wildfire. And a lot of it depends on individual reactions. Just the smell of fire for some people in the air can result in a traumatic response. But I think there's three things to look at. You want to look at the severity of the response, the length of time of the response, and the impact on the functioning of the person. So concern too that beyond just PTSD is, as the disasters go on, one of the things that we are acutely aware of and concerned about is the increased risk for suicide. You know, with COVID-19 and the fires, you've had people lose their homes, you've had people lose their jobs, you've had people lose their insurance. So really making sure that you're checking in with the people in your household, as well as checking with yourself about how you're feeling. And if there are people who are feeling suicidal or feeling like they're overwhelmed or they want to throw the towel in, really connecting them to someone. There are services available. What we're finding is a lot of people aren't aware that they can qualify for it very quickly, usually within 30 days, and to get connected and seen same day, next day, if they need to get mental health counseling.
Scott Kennelly of Butte County Behavioral Health speaking with NSBR's Mark Albert. And that's our final special coverage program. Stay tuned for local news during Morning Edition and All Things Considered in the future. And as always, we still welcome your comments at 433-9216 or our website, mynspr.org. This program was produced by Tess Vigland, Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Andre Bayek, Angel Horacha, and Phil Wilkie. I'm Matt Fidler, the technical producer at North State Public Radio. Keep well, North State, and stay tuned to NSPR, North State Public Radio.